This is the Breaker.News podcast for April 8th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this episode, regular features such as the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim, headlines from around the Pacific Rim, Cascadia Calling, headlines from around the Pacific Northwest, The Big Deal feature. We explore the implications of the Facebook data mining scandal with special guest Mike Larson from the British Columbia Freedom of Information and Privacy Association. And The Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a special pair of people who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or should both the public and the media in Metro Vancouver take a bow for successfully shaming the greedy leaders of the Metro Vancouver Board of Directors to change their minds about taking more from the public trough than they were entitled? On March 23rd, various mayors and councillors from around the region met and decided to vote themselves an $1,100 a year pension that they could collect when they quit office or are defeated in an election in their home municipality. Those that had been on the unelected board since 2007 were going to pocket another $11,000, in addition to the $387 they receive for attending board meetings, and if those board meetings pass the four-hour mark, they get $775 a pop. Chair Greg Moore, the Port Coquitlam mayor, and Vice Chair Raymond Louis, the Vancouver City Councillor, stood to benefit the most. Moore is already paid more than $160,000 a year to be a politician. He would have collected another $65,000 this fall if his sneaky plan had gone ahead. He now claims it was all a mistake because he has heard the complaints of citizens. A motion to reverse the dumb decision is coming at the April 27th board meeting. The announcement came while Moore, Louis, and other local politicians were on a junket to sunny and warm Brisbane, Australia, to meet local politicians and try out the city's light rail system. They call this trip down under a fact-finding mission, but the facts are the daytime temperatures are in the high 20s, and they're not paying the bill for their flights or hotels. You are. While citizens can be satisfied that their voices were heard, they can only be disappointed that they won't be able to throw a bum like Moore out of office this fall because he's quitting the job after three terms. What do you think? Email me your thoughts. Bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. ABC News in Australia's Elise Kinsella reports free Commonwealth Games Wi-Fi to expose Gold Coast visitors' Facebook data. The Gold Coast City Council is offering free Wi-Fi to visitors at the Commonwealth Games, but people using Facebook to log into the service will have their data mined by council for tourism marketing. The council has spent more than $5 million Australian dollars laying fiber cables so it can offer high-speed internet to visitors in parts of Surfers Paradise, Broadbeach, and Southport during the games. Gold Coast Mayor Tom Tate said council would be using the data it collects through Facebook to help future tourism campaigns. Sydney University data privacy expert, Associate Professor Yuri Gal, said Facebook would be able to see when visitors use the Wi-Fi service and council would potentially be able to collect a vast amount of information. The 21st Commonwealth Games opened April 4th and run through April 15th in Queensland, Australia. In the South China Morning Post, why Chinese sperm donors now have to answer the Communist Party's call. A major sperm bank in Beijing has told donors they must pledge loyalty to the ruling Communist Party amid the party's ongoing drive to exert its dominance over all aspects of life. The Third Hospital of Peking University says donors must have favorable political qualities. They must love the socialist motherland and embrace the leadership of the Communist Party. Apart from meeting the political requirements, would-be donors must be over 20 years old and show no obvious signs of hair loss, color blindness, or weight problems. Those who pass the test will be paid 200 renminbi, or 40 Canadian dollars, immediately, and those who successfully donate will be rewarded with 5,500 renminbi, which is more than $1,100 Canadian. In the Anchorage Daily News, Zaz Hollander reports, "Just don't do that. Man kicks moose and gets similar treatment. A man who kicked a moose April 5th received minor injuries and a major lesson in how not to treat wildlife," authorities say. The man, who was not identified, encountered a cow with a calf at his home, according to Alaska State Troopers and the Houston Fire Department. Wildlife officials say this time of year makes for unpredictable moose, tired from a long winter and often protective about their young. The guy apparently walked up to the cow and kicked it because he wanted it to move out of his way, Troopers spokeswoman Megan Peters said in an email. "I'm also not a moose mind reader, but I am fairly certain the cow did not like this, as it kicked back and then left with its calf in tow," end quote. It's unclear whether he was kicked or stomped. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Seattle PI, Danielle DeMay reports, "Save time, not money, with seaplane flights to Vancouver, BC. Kenmore Air and Harbor Air are launching twice daily seaplane flights between Seattle and Vancouver on April 26th. The one-hour flights go from Lake Union near the Amazon campus to Cole Harbor in downtown Vancouver. They won't be cheap, about $370 Canadian one way. But it will be quicker than going airport to airport or driving 3 hours up the I-5. Microsoft President Brad Smith said the new direct seaplane route would be an important link in connecting the Cascadia Innovation Corridor. This association between two historic Pacific Northwest companies will accelerate cross-border business and collaboration for the entire region, Smith said. In the Oregonian, Lizzie Acker reports, Portland chef uses Martin Luther King Jr. assassination anniversary to promote her fried chicken. A well-known Portland chef got an angry response after she chose to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. by sharing a picture of her restaurant's fried chicken on social media. She apologized the next day. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. died April 4, 1968, Jan Louie wrote on an Instagram post, later tweeted by several people. One of his favorite foods was fried chicken. We know he would have loved Israeli fried chicken if he had the chance to try it. Louis is the owner and chef of Ray, an Israeli restaurant in a historically black neighborhood. Louis posted an apology to her Facebook page, writing, "After reflecting on this over the last 24 hours, I realize I unintentionally and very sadly made an error in judgment. I sought a way to mark out this painful anniversary and to pay tribute to MLK's remarkable fight for equality," she continued. "I connect through food, and learning that this was one of his favorites made me excited to share it." And in the Breaker this week, we reported these British Columbia stories about how a Vancouver company that ruined a Burnaby Royal Canadian Legion helped swing a deal for 600 acres of vacant land near Palm Springs, California. How the NDP government is spending your money on advertising contracts with a company that helped get it elected. How TransLink is rebranding the SkyTrain division after a $600,000 fine from WorkSafe BC for putting two electricians in danger. One of them suffered serious burns last year. And how a South Asian campaign organizer with one too many lawsuits was involved with NPA City Councillor Hector Bremner's by-election campaign. Read those and more in the Breaker.News. That's Cascadia Calling for this week on the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for the big deal. Mike Larson, our special guest this week, is a criminology professor at Kwantlen Polytechnic University in British Columbia. That's where he researches security, policing, and access to information and state secrecy. He is also the president of the British Columbia Freedom of Information and Privacy Association, which promotes and defends both freedom of information and privacy rights of citizens. Online privacy, or lack thereof, is in the news around the world, as the public learns more about how Facebook really operates. Edward Snowden has called Facebook a surveillance company. We learned this week that data from 87 million Facebook users was shared with data mining political firm Cambridge Analytica. More than 600,000 of those were Canadians. We welcome Mike Larson to the Breaker.News podcast to talk about this issue. Facebook is a business that's built on attracting eyeballs and selling those eyeballs to advertisers who want to know the details of what goes on in the brains behind those eyeballs. Now, do you think that this will change Facebook or will change the attitudes of users towards Facebook?
I think it may actually change Facebook and the attitudes of users towards Facebook in the specific sense because of the publicity around this particular case, because of the scrutiny, because of ongoing investigations, both by some fantastic investigative reporters and also, of course, by information and privacy commissioners in Canada and in the UK. So I think that level of scrutiny may result in change of practices, has already resulted in some swiftly made announcements and promises from Facebook. And I think it may, as we see with Facebook stock and we see with the delete Facebook movement, may lead some people to say, well, I'm going to take my data off of this. The issue, though, for me is that, you know, Facebook really isn't the problem here. I mean, in the immediate sense, of course, Facebook is intimately involved with what took place with release of an access to unauthorized personal information. But as Snowden points out, this is the business model of social media in general. This is what I like Harcourt's term for this. Bernard Harcourt says we're living in an expository society where, you know, all around us are incentives to expose ourselves, to expose our data, to release and exchange personal information, to watch each other and be watched. And so I don't think that what we're seeing right now is going to lead to a massive social shift in the way that we deal with that kind of stuff. In fact, in many ways, the intensive focus on Facebook may allow some other companies to sneak up behind with some comparable business models.
Yeah, there has been worry expressed in years gone by about corporations who want to market products and services to the public using digital media, using social media. Now we're finding out some of the most aggressive in this space have been actually politicians and their campaigners. And there's also been worry expressed that they have actually been able to subvert democracy or bastardize democracy by using social media, by using misinformation and disinformation. We're seeing this play out as we learn more about the Trump campaign in 2016 versus Clinton's campaign. Of course, the Clinton campaign was not lily white either. We're also learning about the Brexit campaign, and there's questions here about political campaigns in Canada, whether it's federally, provincially, or even municipally. Vision Vancouver, we may learn someday more about its alliance with a company like Hootsuite and Vision Critical that helped them become digital leaders in getting their messages across. But talk about that dynamic, that we've always been thinking corporations, but actually the most aggressive in this space have been political.
You know, there are very few capacities for people in Canada to exercise privacy rights vis-a-vis political parties, right? They are operating largely outside the scope of our privacy laws. And so not only are they actively involved in the use of social media for analytics and for a deep targeting and algorithmic prediction of markets, but they're also largely beyond the kind of scrutiny that we would expect from public bodies, from a government, let's say. And this is an issue that I think needs to be changed. It's an issue that the Privacy Commissioner of Canada has called for change on. There are other countries that are doing this much better. So that's a solution in part. That's a step forward on this issue. In a broader sense, though, you know, I think that what's happened here is that social media has allowed all sorts of different actors, including political actors, to basically act as intelligence organizations. You know, and the intelligence business is based on collecting information, making it actionable through some kind of predictive capacity, right? Intelligence is always about trying to figure out what's going to happen downstream. How can we predict the behavior of adversaries? And you know, the social media engagement that we have allows this vast pool of data to be accessed by political parties for this purpose. Now, whether politicians and political parties see the voting public as adversaries, I mean, I think it's an interesting question to consider, but it's not surprising at all to me that we see political parties operating in this field. The amount of money that it costs to get data packages from a company like AggregateIQ, when we look at some of the budget that was spent in the Brexit campaign, let's say, I'm sure a lot of political campaigns regard this as money well spent. To be able to get, in a fairly short turnaround, reams of predictive information that allows for not just the targeted, campaigning towards people who might be receptive to a message, but also towards some fairly nefarious disruption and discouragement activities. This is dollar for dollar more politically, I think, inviting than your traditional broadcast media public message campaigns. But you use the term, does it bastardize democracy? And I think certainly it. It undermines democracy, at least the vision of democracy we have as something that's based nominally on a level playing field and open public discourse.
Now, what kind of solutions might there be? I think regulation for Facebook is inevitable if it's going to stay alive. There's no mm-hmm. reason why Facebook should be less regulated than radio and TV networks, for instance. But what kind of other solutions might there be so that we know who is actually putting messages out on social media networks, as well as we know that people who are using social media networks are not being used for data mining? What kind of solutions would you propose?
Well, I think we need a full spectrum of solutions, right? So there's the immediate steps that individuals can take. There's immediate steps involving, personal audits. What are my privacy settings? How am I engaged in use of social media? What are the implications of persistent login when I have all of my accounts logged in across all of my devices everywhere I go? What kind of data is that leaking out? And, people today can go to the companies that they have accounts with and adjust their privacy settings. And that's an important first step. And there are a variety of organizations. I would mention the Electronic Frontier Foundation, for example, that offers some tools for those kinds of steps. So I think a more conscious user approach is important, just as an immediate kind of triage. However, this isn't something that I think can be solved by downloading it on the user, the citizen, the consumer. This is something that requires much larger scale organizing. So in terms of steps along those lines, I think that the European Union's General Data Protection Regulation, which is going to be coming online soon, requires greater transparency on the part of social media companies, on the part of other companies, around how they are actually collecting information from individuals, what it's going to be used. And it's based on a principle of informed consent. I think one of the issues is that we all experience check-ins around our consent to the use of personal information, but they're often these inscrutable user license agreements that are very difficult to actually parse for privacy experts, but for the individual as well. So greater transparency around and clarity around exactly what is being collected, how it is being stored, and for what purpose, and what are the limits of collection and use. That's something that we can build into regulation. But that requires a political conversation. That requires a public conversation about what we expect. And right now, I would just say that our privacy laws and our access to information laws tend to map onto an analog terrain as opposed to a digital society. So it's time for a lot of revision there. My last general point on this is that we desperately need education on this. It's really remarkable when you take a look at the curriculum for high school, let's say, or elementary school in British Columbia, and even in universities. Where in our public education system do we attempt in a concerted effort to equip people to make informed decisions about not only their own personal privacy, but how they interact with the personal information of others? We've kind of left this, in part because it's grown up around us, we've kind of left this to individuals to sort out for themselves and for companies to be, proactively involved in regulating for themselves. And now here we are. So I think a big part of rectifying this situation and ensuring that we don't run into these kind of problems in the future is to invest in public education around privacy, not just as a workshop or an add-on seminar, but as something that we build into how we understand history, how we understand society, communications, interaction. I say that as an educator, of course. I'm always going to come back to a education recommendation, but I think it's important.
Our guest was Mike Larson, criminology professor from Kwantlen Polytechnic University and the president of the British Columbia Freedom of Information and Privacy Association. You can find BC FIPA online at fipa.bc.ca. That's FIPA.bc.ca. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who made a difference. This week, a virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes to two groups of people, united by hockey. First, to the police, fire, ambulance, and hospital personnel who responded to the Humboldt Broncos tragedy in Saskatchewan on April 6th. British Columbia salutes you for your brave public service. The families and friends of the dead and injured are in our hearts and in our minds. We also salute Daniel and Henrik Sedin. British Columbia's favorite Swedish twins retired April 7th. They are the greatest Vancouver Canucks of all time. The Sedin twins' humble, hard-working ethic, their on-ice achievements and awards, their work in the community to put smiles on the faces of sick children and to make BC Children's Hospital even better than it is. Vancouver is a better place because of you, Daniel and Henrik. You deserve automatic induction to the BC Sports Hall of Fame to join all-time West Coast legends like BC Lion Louis Pisaglia, Vancouver Whitecap and 86er Carl Valentine, and lacrosse-playing twins Gary and Paul Gate. Let's all say tack, which is Swedish for thank you, to Daniel and Henrik Sedin for all they've done. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for April 8th, 2018. Did you know that on April 8th, 1974, in Atlanta, Hank Aaron hit career home run number 715, breaking Babe Ruth's record? And on April 8th, 1975, Frank Robinson debuted as manager of the Cleveland Indians to become the first black manager in Major League Baseball. Well, now you know. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas. The email address is bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.